this citizens involvement committee concept really work, where somebody could come in and be heard and get information and have a conduit to the ways in which their money was being spent. So the new framework of the Citizens Involvement Committee will not involve having a formal chairperson, and it can't be denied that the CIC needed to be reframed or morphed into an updated format with new and improved ways of doing things and reaching the public. So I'm sort of going to pass the baton to the AMAC staff tonight, and I just want to say thanks to Mr. Baker and the AMAC staff for all the hard work they've done during my contact with AMAC. They've become not just people I see every so often, but they've become friends of mine, and I hope they feel the same way. They worked a lot of hours, a lot of days on projects, and then extended their days into the evening hours by coming to the TAC and CIC and then attending the policy committee. So there have been thousands and thousands of hours that they've devoted to their craft. So we're lucky to have these young professionals in our area, and they all are serving us well. So with that, I'm going to pass the baton to Mr. Baker, Curtis Baker, and I'll let him do the next part of the agenda, which is the review of the last meeting summary, which was December 11th. Sounds like a long time ago to me. But Curtis, why don't you go ahead and take it from there.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Ondecker, and obviously we really appreciate your service. In fact, I did want to give this to you as a special thanks from our staff.
Oh, wow.
Says the Akron Metropolitan Transportation Policy Committee wishes to express its appreciation for Michael Ondecker for his service as chairperson of the AMAC Citizen Involvement Committee during the years of 2005 through 2014. That was through a records check. And this certificate issued to Mr. Ondecker in recognition for his dedication to quality transportation planning and his commendable participation on the CIC. His dutiful service is a benefit to all within the greater Akron area, and signed by Jason, our director. So we really appreciate your service.
And this is a great memento. Thanks to AMATS and all of you. It's a pleasure to be on the treasure of this always, I sincerely will. So thank you.
Moving on, review of the last meeting summary. One of the things that we are changing is we aren't going to have as procedural minutes like we used to, but we will continue to include basically a similar review of what you've seen before. And as a recollection for those of you who were at the meeting or those of you who weren't, the biggest thing that we did was we decided to suspend the bylaws of the CIC for the next calendar year, which starts now, started January 1st, with the idea of trying a new format, fewer meetings, and more of an open topics instead of following the agenda that we have for TAC and policy verbatim, with the staff trying to bring up things that we're working on currently so we can get input on those things, and really, I think, provide the ability for, hopefully to invite more people, bring more membership, or bring more people willing to come out and kind of share their opinion on transportation. So with that, though, those are the minutes that we did have. Please let me know if you see anything that you think was in error. We can get that corrected, but we will continue to provide those to record in a public meeting. So basically, I guess we're going to start agenda number three. We've got the discussion items. And basically, the three things we really want to talk about today are sort of give you an update for where we are, And then Nate's going to have a presentation on, Dave is going to have a presentation on the road diets and the road diet analysis. And then we're also going to have a presentation on demographics and their impact on transportation. Bear with us with the computer. We're trying to get it up. It appears to be being very stubborn today. So we'll see what we have to do about that. Basically, for an agency update, it's actually been pretty quiet the last couple weeks with holidays and the new year. There hasn't been a lot of movement on a lot of fronts. From the federal level, it's been a really interesting time, interesting discussions, because with gas prices as low as they are, it's starting to create some discussion about maybe this is the time to have a gas tax debate, have a gas tax increase. Some people are still really against that, and there have been discussions about other ways to get a bill through. The goal is to have a bill this calendar year that will replace the current federal legislation. We're hoping that, or there's some hope that there will be a full bill, you know, for multiple years, like a 4 or 5 year bill. And really the biggest thing right now that we're hearing is, other than gas tax, is the idea of paying for this through, not sure the right way they say it, but it's a Rand Paul and Barbara Boxer are suggesting this, that they tax income from the U.S. companies make from overseas transactions. And those, that it's like a corporate loophole that they would try to close with all of that money being funneled into transportation investments. So sounds a little sketchy, but we'll see if that'll do the trick and get us a full bill. other than that, the major things that we are working on right now are the road diet analysis, which Dave is going to talk about a little bit, and then also we're getting ready in this year and next year, we'll be getting up to date on our next plan and updating our big transportation plan for 2040. So
we just finished the 2035.
Yeah, I know. So we finished the 2040 plan will be due in May of 2017, and that does go pretty quickly, at least from our end. So yeah, it's time to start talking about 2040, which is pretty frightening. but anyway, with that, we'll ask Nate to come up, and it looks like we cannot get this projector to actually display our items. So, Nate, I don't know if you're going to be able to wing it, or...
Dave first, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. There was a flash.
Hey, there it is.
Okay, so this screen on the laptop went blank, but you can control it.
Okay.
You can see
12 foot
screen. Dave, is yours on here already?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Do you want me to get started? Want me to put it on there? Or are you gonna...
Just run it up.
Yeah.
I apologize for the technical difficulties, but as Curtis mentioned, we are working on a road diet project at AMETS, and for those of you who don't know what a road diet is, how many of you have heard this term before? Have you all heard?
I've heard it, but I forget what it means.
Okay. For those of you who don't know what a road diet is actually reducing the number of lanes on a street. And That it's kind of counterintuitive to what we're usually thinking about. We're usually always in transportation. We're usually always thinking about expansion, capacity, adding lanes. But a road diet is actually reducing lanes. And one of the most common types of road diets is reducing a four-lane highway to a three-lane highway. And typically what's done is the three lanes are one lane in each direction and then a median turn lane. And then the lane that is dropped is usually divided up between each side and is turned into a bike lane. So that is a road diet. And road diets also have a lot of safety benefits. In the AMATS area, one out of three crashes is a rear-end crash. And I also work with safety, so I mean, I kind of know that firsthand. And by reducing four lanes to three and putting in that center turn lane, what that does is that that gets all left turning traffic out of the way of the through traffic. So it also has a lot of safety benefits also. And of course it does make biking safer. It also reduces conflict points. Conflict points in the transportation safety world, conflict points is a point where two cars can have an accident, where two cars can collide and have an accident. And I see that our IT person here finally did. Let's just leave it right here.
Right there?
Yeah.
I can.
Okay. So anyhow, as I was saying, one of the most common types of road diets is taking four lanes, which you see on the left, and reducing it to three. And you have one lane in each direction plus that median turn lane. And then the extra space is divided up for a bike lane. And this can also be done in areas where you have parking. As you can see, the top example is a typical four-lane street with parking. And then the bottom diagram shows how they pretty much leave the parking where it is, and then just reconfigure the four lanes as they would any other on any other streets. As I said, safety benefits are also a big benefit. It reduces vehicular speed, improves sight distance, it improves pedestrian and bicycle safety, and reduces conflict points between vehicles. Okay, on a typical segment, a four-lane undivided highway has six conflict points. A conflict point is where two cars can hit each other, have an accident. It reduces it six conflict points to three. And one of the big advantages is you lose one of your rear end conflict points, and then you lose two side swipe conflict points. And then with an intersection, it reduces the conflict points from eight. Go ahead. It reduces conflict points from eight to four. So it definitely helps safety by reducing conflict points. So a road diet really benefits all modes of transportation. It improves mobility and walkability, safety, and quality of life. Why would we want to do this in our area? Well, actually, Akron and typical of many Midwest cities isn't growing as fast or nearly as fast as once thought. Many of our streets are overbuilt and the capacity far exceeds the volume. Another big thing is our traffic volumes are stable or even in some cases decreasing. There's a renewed interest in bicycling, and once again, it improves safety, especially the rear end crashes, which in our area account for nearly a third of all vehicular crashes. Some of the criteria that we look at when we try to choose which streets are good for a road diet should be four undivided lanes. Sometimes two really wide lanes would work, but typically four undivided lanes. I've looked at different sources. Some sources say you can do it with an average traffic volume of 20,000. My own personal opinion is I think 15,000 is a much more acceptable and reasonable level or ADT. And also you have to look at peak hour, because peak hour is also important. A directional volume of probably 900 or less would be a maximum peak hour volume. And this number is also debatable. You have to look at truck and bus traffic, because or any vehicle really that moves slower, because you can't pass as easily because you only have one lane in each direction. Steep grades slow down heavy vehicles, and you don't have that ability to pass as easily. And then you also have to take into consideration access points and turning movements along the route.
Dave, what would Market Street be? West Market Street near Highland Square, what count, just to give a frame of reference on a higher end count?
I think it's around 15,000.
15,000.
Yeah, so.
Pretty busy primary arterial. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes. Here's some examples. I picked out a few road diet examples that we have in our area. This is Maple Street in Akron. For those of you who aren't familiar, if you drive east on Copley Road crosses Cedar Street, then it crosses Exchange Street, and then it turns into Maple Street. This is probably one of the best candidates in the area that I can think of for a road diet. It's four wide lanes. It doesn't really have parking, and it only has an ADT. It has an ADT of less than 6,000. Another example is East Exchange Street. This is actually east of Route 8, like between Route 8 and Arlington. Once again, four lanes and an ADT of less than 10,000. And one more example I picked out was North Main Street. This is North Main Street, north of Cuyahoga Falls Avenue. A lot of pavement, four wide lanes, and then you also have parking on each side, and you still have an ADT of less than around 10,000. So those were just three examples. With our analyses, what we're doing is applying this criteria to our roadway network. We're trying to identify which streets are good candidates. And then we're attempting, once we get all the streets selected, we're trying to, come up with a short list, like of all the streets that are potential candidates, which ones would be the best candidates to start with. So, and then we also want to make the communities aware of this. And one advantage of a road diet is it doesn't really require a lot of extra money for infrastructure. Road diets are usually done when a street is resurfaced, and it's just a matter of restriping in those cases. In fact, if any money is spent on a road diet, it's usually money spent for maybe planning or engineering, but as far as infrastructure costs, there's very little additional cost. The final report should be done by the end of February, hopefully, and then it will be presented to the policy and the technical advisory committee and policy meeting in March. And then we'll we'll post this on our website with hard copies available. So that concludes my presentation on road diets. Any questions? Yes.
Will your final report, once that's approved by the two committees, does that go? Does that become what you are going to advocate, or is that something you have to go back to the cities and tell them we suggest you do this? You're going to be able to make them do that, or?
No, I don't believe we can make them do it. I think we can just suggest it. Like all we can do is say, here are the streets in your community that we feel are good candidates. And when it comes time to resurface or improve that street, you should consider this.
Will that be part of the consideration of whether they get funding when they come in with the project?
I think, yeah. The intent is to have that list so when we do get those applications in, we can say, this is a great candidate for a road diet. And, you know, one of the things that we found, too, or just in discussing with some local communities, is that even though in some places this isn't that new of an idea, it is sort of here. And even in Twinsburg, I was talking with their city engineer, and there was interest, but it was like, well, what is the threshold? Like, what roads can I look at, and what roads can't I? And so the purpose of this really is to sort of be like, look, these are the roads that meet that criteria. You know, you can consider these things. And so really for us, it's like it's as much education as it is implementation at this point, because we're trying to give our community some good guidelines for kind of what would be that perfect project. Like, roads like Maple Street is a great example, but those are like slam dunks. You know, the thing that we hear a lot of is like, well, there's 13,000 cars, it seems pretty busy, can I get away with it? That's where I think that more analysis, and they have to really dig deeper to make sure that, you know, they don't end up doing way too much negative damage to the road in terms of level of service.
I did want to mention one thing. I didn't put it in my slide, but I know for sure one project in our existing TIP for road diet, and that's Talmadge Avenue between North Main and Route 8. And that is actually a project being designed, and the funding is in place for it. And the ADT in that segment is around 16,000, I believe. So it'll be interesting to see how that all works out.
She's really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Drive on that road, it's feeling good.
It is.
I think having a center turn right
the best
there
would
be so much nicer.
And that's all. Isn't that one of the most dangerous ones for pedestrians?
Yes.
Isn't that?
Yeah. Although I think the school's on the other. I think the project stops at the bridge, Dave.
Yes.
Route 8.
Yes. Because you really need those lanes going over Route 8, or because you need to turn lanes and you need the capacity there. And then also, interesting thing about Talmadge Avenue is then once you get beyond like Home Avenue, it's been widened already to five lanes. But that ADT there, I'm not sure how you, technically that wouldn't be a road diet, but you could probably lose a lane through there and put in bike lanes, but it'll be interesting to see. The section between North Main and Route 8 is actually in our TIP as a project, so we'll see how that turns out. Yes?
In addition to just simply remarking the pavement, are you looking at areas of, say, Goodyear Boulevard up at Goodyear Heights where it's five or six lanes wide, even though they're not marked,
yeah,
potentially reducing the actual footprint of the road, moving curb lines and stuff like that, is that included?
You know, those are a little bit harder to pick up because we're not quite as on top of some of those streets as we are. You know, the I think that's two lanes. That's considered two lanes, but that will be included. If there's going to be a group of streets that we miss, and I just know it's going to happen because there's going to be there's just going to be streets that slip through the cracks, and we're going to depend on communities and just citizens and people who are interested in this to tell us about those. But that's actually a good example, because I know for sure that is a lot of pavement.
Yeah, well, trolley lines.
Yeah, I know for sure that's a lot of pavement, and that I'm sure there's probably enough space there to do that. Yeah. So I'm going to make a note of that and look at that tomorrow.
Yeah, I think a lot of those projects are kind of, you know, ones that you just almost need that local expertise on. But it is something that, like with the Twinsburg one, the main thing was Chamberlain Road near south of 82 to Highland, where the stamping plant was. And it's four lanes and there's a median, you know, that's a vegetation median. And they want to get rid of it from the maintenance perspective. They don't like maintaining that set of median, cutting whatever is in there and all that. So there is that. But doing that, it turns into more of a reconstruction and the cost goes, you know, up a lot higher. And that's where probably would be projects where, unlike the ones where they could just stripe it, those would be ones they'd really have to come to us or fund it, you know, that you'd be looking at a lot more money.
Mr. May? Comment. Some of us think those wide streets should have trolleys put back on them. Serious question. Some of those road conditions, the pavements didn't look too bad. Are some of those roads looking for a repaving cycle anytime soon?
Oh.
I don't see any bumps, potholes.
Oh, this is something that...
long-term?
Yeah, this is something long-term. Now, Exchange Street...
That one's looking a little rough. I see some cracks.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, this is a long-term thing, and
that would be expensive to scrape up that paint and redo it.
Right, right. So it's most practical to do it when it's resurfaced. I mean, you probably could change the lane markings without resurfacing, but I just never liked how that looks. Yeah.
And what does the literature say about public opinion?
That's something that I was going to mention is
resistance.
Yeah, this has to be kind of accepted by the community. I mean, there's just some places this won't be accepted too well.
Hikers will like it.
City of Akron, when they did the Copley Road diet, one of the things that they got a lot of criticism on was the fact that they just didn't do a great job from a public involvement standpoint. So it was like the community, it was almost like, I mean, that wasn't quite like this, but one day they woke up and there was like, where'd my lanes go? In a completely different configuration. And I think the city has been trying to learn from that experience and take more steps to be a little bit more proactive. And that one was one because they're like, we're resurfacing, let's just do it, you know. And it was, they did it really quick, and it was a spur of the moment decision. And I know now with some of the other ones, they're really trying to learn from that and get a little bit more public involvement.
Yeah, involve the press. Where's this at here? Is that somewhere in our area?
No, you know what? I grabbed that off of. I think I grabbed that off of like a Federal Highways website. So I don't believe that's in our area. I was looking at a lot of different websites, and I think I saw that it was a good example. But if you could go back to that, I did want to mention one more thing. No, back to the first one, the very first slide. One thing that sometimes I hear people talk about is this wide center turn lane. I hear people sometimes ask, you know, why is that center turn lane so much wider than it needs to be? Because as you can see, these look maybe 11 or 12, and that looks about 14. And the reason this is done when there's space to do it is if you have a car turning, left in this direction and a car turning left in this direction, they can kind of be offset a little bit so they can see around each other. That's why sometimes you see a wide center turn lane. It's so the cars can, if they're both turning left, they can, and they're facing each other, they can kind of be offset enough to kind of see around each other.
From a small business standpoint, is there any studies supporting like economic development or anything like that with road diets? Or does road diets help businesses that are long, or is there any study out there that has said anything about that, or that you're aware of?
I think I've seen something.
I I don't know offhand.
It'd be a good thing, though.
It would be. I'll make a note of that. But I'm thinking that people on bikes, like if you're on a bike, you're just, I think, more likely maybe to stop. Like if you see a small business like a coffee shop or an antique store or something, I think it's maybe people on bikes. You're moving, you see things more.
That's exactly right. You do see things more. Our studies that show that whereas there are bike trails or lanes, that there is an increase.
It's just easier to drive by something than it is to ride by something.
I think that's something that I would definitely add when it comes to the community involvement aspect. You're presenting it to regular citizens. Let's talk about some of that stuff.
That wouldn't be a bad thing to include in the report itself. It's actually in the writing of the document. Some of the, if there is some economic, if we can, if they're out there, we'll find them.
Yeah.
That's a good comment.
Google shows some hits.
Yeah. Yeah. There we go. Perfect.
I'll send this an email to somebody.
Just to be facetious, do you consider MLK a project up here as being a dot road guy? The ultimate road guy? closing down the
path. Yeah, in name only, But it is interesting, we were talking to the city engineer at Kent, and they're talking about, 261, 43, it's like, it was built basically to connect to the Interbelt, and Kent wants to do something, they would like to do something that would minimize from a maintenance perspective and from a safety perspective, because you've got all these roads that are, feed into it, that are 25 mile an hour university roads, and people are going 65, and it's one of their highest crash locations. And no matter what they do from a intersection configuration, those crashes remain. So talking to them, they're like, we would love to reduce the lanes and reduce the speeds and do that. So so I think that's like a, to me that's probably a little more like a road diet than the Interbelt itself, because I don't think most road diets would have parking decks and, businesses built on top
of
them.
You can make a heck of a bike lane out of it.
That's right. That's right. Well, you can use it now as a bike lane. I think you'd survive. You can take the right lane and nobody would notice. Any other questions for Dave or?
Are any of these roads, any chance that some of these really super wide ones in particularly urban areas that we could accommodate protected bike lanes?
Protected by like a
meat separation,
Even like with a berm or a curb or bollards or bollards you could definitely do. Just from a width perspective, that doesn't take up much space. I know when the city of Akron did bollards on South Street, when they did the cycle track on South Street, somebody came by and ripped them all out because they didn't like them. So I don't know if bollards are
the plastic tube-like things.
Yeah, they're the plastic tube things, and some of they're gone now. But they started that way.
Snow plows
by there. I've even seen, if you just had a 1 foot by 18 inch high, that provides that level of comfort that, you wouldn't have otherwise. That it would probably depend on the right-of-way of the street. Mm-hmm. I wonder about, if something like maple.
Yeah, you typically don't see that. You just typically don't see that in a road diet. I'm not saying you can't do it, but you just typically don't see the protected.
And that would also increase the cost,
add
the physical infrastructure, which is probably why they don't do it, because it's a quick fix. You could definitely do it if you have the money.
Now, I've seen these, and once again, I don't know if you could do it in this area of weather, but I've seen these where these bike lanes are painted as a whole separate color, different color. Mm-hmm. I've seen them painted green. I don't know if that...
A lot of cost to that.
Yeah, and that wouldn't last long in this weather.
There are reasons you don't want to separate or have a berm in there for a bike lane, because as long as you're along the street like that, you're going to get all the dirt from the road kicked into the bike lane.
Yeah.
And then there's, if you can't get the sheet.
Yeah, the water, the crown of the road.
You couldn't even plow it or anything.
Right.
I think it works better with plowed in a case like this.
Right. We move on to the next presentation. Nate, I will try to get this down.
administrator.
All right. Do you want me to do it, or do you want to?
Okay.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, whatever you're more comfortable with.
Good evening, everyone. As was mentioned earlier, it seems like we just completed one plan, and now it's on to the other one. It's because there's so many things. We do little building blocks that kind of trickle and feed into other things. We work on all these sub-reports, and they all feed into the big plan. That's why we get such an early start. And one of the first things we have to do is develop those building blocks. And we kind of do that by getting by wrapping our hands around the demographics of the area. Why do we study demographics? That's something I'm working on right now. They're really fundamental to our entire planning effort. We can see what's going on out there before our eyes right now, but to plan, you've got to know where you're going to go. So we do this to kind of look to the future, and we want to see where growth is likely to occur, and just as important, sometimes where we may be expecting decline to happen. And one particular report we work on, just the whole process, is called the congestion management process. And what that does is look at where congestion is possibly going to be on our roadways and everything out in the future. So working on demographics kind of feeds into that as well. So it all starts off after a lot of calculations, and we'll kind of get into that. The outputs of studying all these demographic data items are... we have a report called the Planning Data Forecast, which kind of, there's just tens of thousands of little data bits, and what this is a nice summary of everything and all the different categories we track and do projections for and everything. I believe that's due around April, so maybe the next CFC meeting we would have that available or sometime around then. And one of the real practical things we do, all these little data pieces we put into our regional traffic model, which is this incredibly complex software package that performs a whole lot of calculations to try to anticipate, you know, where traffic's coming from, where it's going to, and everything. We'll get into why these data pieces are so important for that. There are about 10 different things that we track. Some of them we use in a whole lot of our products. Looking at population projections, employment projections, we actually track 25 categories of employment, things like manufacturing, science, and tech jobs, education, retail, all different kinds of categories. And then we also just aggregate them and kind of look at the total employment picture for a community and the region. And median household income is another important one we look at. A lot of things we do look at where low-income areas are, and we try to make sure, you know, our projects are spread equally and not disproportionately affecting one area or another. So that's a data piece that kind of comes into a lot of the things we do at AMATS. Those are the widely used ones. There's a lot of other data sets that we track that we have to put into the model. Number of vehicles, households, age-related things, and just a lot of other variables that go into it all. So how do we get this information? There's a wide variety of data sources that we use. The number one source for at least current data is the U.S. Census Bureau. Every 10 years we get good definite data, and they used to track a lot more things. They've kind of pared it back, so really that gives you a good handle on the actual population. Any other data item, they produce a lot of info, but that comes from the American Community Survey, which is a survey. It's very comprehensive. They send it out to thousands of households, and this is annually, and they track a lot of detailed things, employment items, just a lot of specific people categories and things like that, even things like, you know, what kind of phone service you have, and commute patterns and things like that. So that's the biggest data source that we use. There are other things we use from the state of Ohio has agencies, some in some cases with population we're kind of required to use some of their data, and it's very beneficial. The Department of Education, you know, like school enrollment numbers is something we track. We could, as an agency, never really get a good handle on that. And luckily, they generate a lot of reports to give us that kind of data. We pull stuff from federal highways, and sometimes we actually have to do, you know, direct contact with people. One of the categories I haven't gotten to this one yet, but is hotel rooms, for instance. And that's, I don't know if there's, since it's private businesses, not a whole lot of publicly available data, so, you know, we'll have to go anywhere from travel guides to calling hotels up themselves if one's under construction, asking how many hotel rooms there are. So there's a lot of different places that we get data from. And we do this pretty infrequently, gathering all this data. So, you know, maybe every 5 or 6 years that we do some of these projections, and the data sources change. So it's hard to just make it like a boilerplate process, you know, that you do the same thing every time, because sources disappear and there's new ways to get things, and they don't always break things down the same way. So each time we go through this cycle, it's kind of a learning experience to just see, and we're always just trying to find the best and most accurate data sources out there. So in a nutshell, how do we determine these? Different categories kind of have different methodologies, as to especially how we project out into the future. 2040 is what we're looking at right now. But especially for population and employment, that we start by gathering existing, like current data, and by current, we use very often a census year, so 2010 is kind of the base year, and then historic data. So we go back a few years too, and we're always keeping that in databases and everything. So we use approximately the last 10 or 12 years or so of data, and if you go back way too far, it tends to skew data. Last time we did this, a community, some people get real picky over the numbers, you know, they're really vested in this, and they want to, you know, sometimes show themselves as a highly growing community and everything. I won't name the community, but, you know, we had a certain projection for them. It seemed really reasonable based on their current growth. And they made the comment, they're like, well, technically, if you look at our population growth going back to 1920, we've grown, you know, 1,000% of the time. And it's just kind of funny. Their model produced like a population that was maybe double of what we did, and it kind of seemed unrealistic. So we don't like to go back way, way too far, because that can kind of skew things. Not to mention it's hard to find data that far back, too, sometimes. So anyway, after we've gathered all this historic data, the last 10 years or so, we just use this pretty simple linear regression. In stats terms, you basically just plot the points and you try to find a trend line. It may be up, it may be down, just depends on the community and everything. And from that, you just extend the line outward and basically come up with a future point from there. When it comes to projections, there is no magic answer for everything. We do the best we can. The data out there is pretty good, but it's not perfect. One real good example that they've shown was that American Community Survey data. They calculate population for cities and everything like every year, basically. And one of the most blatant examples of just how off it can be is in 2009, they released a survey, and for the city of Detroit, they estimated there were about 916,000 people in just the city of Detroit. And then 1 year later, the actual census, 2010, where they actually do a real head count, and that data is extremely reliable, turns out there are only 713,000 people. And I know they have they're losing population, but not at that rate. That's definitely kind of not a great estimate. Now, that's an extreme example, but there are times where you look at the historic data, like 2009 and 2010, you're like, whoa, that's quite a difference. But in some cases, that's kind of all we got, and we smooth things out what we can, and if things seem terribly off or anything. But generally, for our area, it seemed pretty good. But that's just an example of the kind of things, like you're kind of at mercy of your data for some of these things. And also, no one can ever get a complete grip on these things. Everything's a moving target. You know, businesses are always opening, closing, people are getting fired, laid off, hired, births, deaths, you know, everything's a moving target. So you never get it right on, and we just try our best, and we tweak things whenever necessary if we see real kind of crazy discrepancies in between years and everything. So going back to how we calculate congestion and the regional traffic model and everything, one thing we do is a starting point is the census breaks areas down into different size units and everything of some various specificity. Well, we have our own internal thing, and this is highly used in the traffic model. We divide the entire region into 835 traffic analysis zones. We'll just call them TAZ for short. These are areas that usually have a definite border. Sometimes it'll be a river, a certain road or something like that, even property lines sometimes do it. But there's usually some attractions in each one of those. And as you see, as you get more rural, they get kind of wider because you try to you don't want something that has absolutely no activity, so where there's not a whole lot going on, you want a bigger traffic zone to kind of capture a decent amount of activity. And then, of course, in the central Akron, you've got, you know, over 100 traffic zones within the city and everything. So to start off the process, yeah, we divide everything into these traffic analysis zones. And then you use it's the four-step traffic modeling process. Back in the day, this literally was done by hand in some communities. They would cordon off areas and survey people who were entering a traffic zone and leaving a traffic zone, asking them where they were going. Just an incredible amount of manpower is required to do something like that. And thank heavens we have really good software out there that does this, and we have a computer traffic model. One of our main things is to put all these data items into there, and it kind of spits out things, and we, you know, tweak it as necessary. So anyway, there's four steps to like really modeling how traffic is going to play out in the future. And in step one, you have to figure out how many trips are generated, and this is where these demographic data items really come into play. Every traffic analysis zone of those 835 will generate a certain number of trips, and the computer figures that out by us putting that data in there. So for an example, just over decades and decades of traffic engineering experience, the people who've programmed these things, you know, they've got a good grip on, like, for every elementary school, there will be, you know, per student, you know, or per 100 students, 20 car trips generated a day. I have no clue if that's accurate or not, but it does things like that. Every hospital will generate 500, you know, vehicle trips per day. Every household may generate 4 vehicle trips per day. So it just looks at each zone, it calculates all that stuff in there for just a grand total number of car trips that will be leaving that traffic zone. It's like generating that traffic zone. So calculating that total number of trips is the first step. The second step of the process is to distribute those trips. Not very specifically, but it's just a real general, okay, you're coming from this area, now where are you going? This is all based on the gravity model. It just means that there are people who live in Akron who will shop in Stowe, but more likely they're going to shop in Fairlawn or Chapel Hill. You know, the things that are closer are considered more attractive, and they're going to take the bulk of the trips, although you have the guy who's going to drive out to Twinsburg for something or whatever. So it uses a just extensive model to kind of figure out who's going where, you know, which zone to which zone they're going. And this is, you know, with 835 zones, just thousands and thousands of possible combinations. So it's a really powerful program that does all this, and I'm glad we have it. After you figure out those trips and where they're going, the next step is to determine the mode that they will be using. For the most part, that's vehicle trips, but we also figure out, just based on history and everything, how many of those trips are likely to be taken by transit or walking and any other means that you have. And then finally, the last step of the process is to actually assign those trips to the transportation network. You're actually saying, okay, most of these people will be taking Route 8 to, you know, Market Street or whatever, you know, just putting them on specific roadways or assigning them to specific bus lines and everything. And then that's the point where we kind of have where we're able to calculate congestion in the future. So what the model does is take basically the current roadway that we have and, you know, layer that expected traffic on top of it. So it looks at the number of lanes on roadways and turnways, the capacity of traffic that each road can carry and everything. And then there's certain levels, you know, where you give a rating, an A through an F or whatever. And sometimes we'll see, like, whoa, you know, this is a high-growth area. They're mostly using Route 91. There's not enough lanes here, most likely. AMATS has kind of transitioned to its fix-it-first method of doing projects. We're kind of looking at the here and now, and we're a slow-growth area. So we're not as concerned about future congestion as, like, an Atlanta or maybe a Phoenix would be or something like that. But it's still something we keep an eye on. Anyway, this feeds into our congestion management report, and we kind of look at all that stuff, and it gives us a long-term idea of, you know, where we need to focus on perhaps building new roads, or if we can also find that traffic's severely dropping in an area, maybe it's time for a road diet somewhere. So basically, after all that said, that's everything feeding the model. Let's just show a couple of our projections here. There's a whole bunch of categories. Tonight I'll just do kind of the most popular two. We'll look at population and employment for the area. From what we've generated at this point, at the community level, this is kind of what we're looking at right now. The greens are growth, darker is higher growth, and then the browns are kind of areas that are decreasing a little bit. The percentages are very large. For instance, it goes up to 73%. This is 73% over a 25-year period. So if you annualize that, I mean, even in the most extreme cases of growth, it looks huge, but it's, you know, 2 to 3%. And ones that just look like they're bleeding population, you divide it, annualize it over 25 years, and, you know, they're losing maybe 0.2% or something each year. So it's not as drastic as it seems in that regard. But just some real quick observations from everything. Sticking with what has happened the last several cycles, we're seeing a lot, we're expecting a lot of growth in the northern portion of the county. It's a real attractive place because it's kind of equidistant between Cleveland and Akron, so it's really convenient for you know, job markets in either city. And Green is in, to the south sometimes, there's an attractiveness there. Almost the same thing. It's kind of the equal spot between Canton and Akron, so those are ideal, you know, strategic places to live. We've always seen quite more growth in Brimfield and Copley, kind of in the middle of everything. There's just a lot of room to grow and a lot of room for development and everything in those, whereas some of the older communities are kind of, you know, maxed out as far as brand new growth. Of course, there's always infill growth, which is a different story we can talk about. But just continuing, also recent trends are that our older industrial cities, your Cuyahoga Falls, Akron, Ravenna, places like that are tending to lose population, definitely not growing real quickly. We hope we're wrong and things change, but just based on, you know, kind of recent history, that's what's kind of shown up. And then if you look at employment, looks kind of more positive. The same thing, green is growth, and the browns are on the decline. Some of the older industrial cities, you know, slightly losing employment, and a lot of it's kind of moving outward. That's a trend we've seen. And there's a lot of green out in Portage County, which is kind of interest, but again, it has a lot of the same hot spots as the population analysis. Up in the north and down to the south is where a lot of the growth is. Some of maybe what you're seeing in Portage County, like Edinburgh Township and everything, one thing about them is they don't have tons of employment out that way, so even, you know, like one new employer of 200 jobs can be a 20% increase in employment, you know, for the entire township, basically. Like, there's a lot of leverage one little business has on, you know, making a big impact on the whole area. So, yeah, that's pretty much what we're seeing right now. We have actually, you know, we have these numbers way down in lower levels and everything, but so you can look at it pretty specifically, but we feel it's kind of more accurate when you aggregate it and look at it at the community level. Traffic zones, you never really know. Yeah. That's fine. Good question. But this is one of the best ways that we kind of just show everything. We feel it's probably the most accurate. That's what we had for demographics at this point. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So you're saying in 2040, Akron's population will be between like 120 and 150,000?
Well,
that's terrifying.
That's one of the things we're always discussing that internally. And I mean, it definitely feels stabilized. And each time we do this, we're hoping this gets better and stuff. But I mean, just looking at the trend line, that's where it's gone and everything.
Yeah.
I definitely don't see it like growing huge. There's a lot of like immigrant population that could, you know, really turn things around. I think,
sure, I think at least stabilize. A year coming from the International Institute, 110.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, I think sometimes it's hard for us because, you know, we're not prognosticators in the sense that, you know, all we can do is put the numbers in and see what we get. But at the same time, I mean, when you look at what Akron's done over the, if you just go back from 1980 to now, it's pretty staggering. And there's not really a great reason to think there's no reason to think that it'll continue to go at that rate. There's also no reason to think that it'll rebound either at this point. You know, and at this point, we haven't done any. Sometimes I think we would, you know, we'll look and consider doing some, I don't want to say like shading or fixing of, you know, because it just looks too extreme. Like two plans ago, we actually did that because Akron complained they didn't want it to look like they were going to be under 200,000 people in 2030. You know, and that was 10 years ago, and now we're under 200,000, that's 2010. So, you know, that's one of the things we struggle with. You know, and then there's things that we don't really have the ability to mathematically look into, like available land, zoning. You know, if you put all that together, new households versus old, you could probably get a more accurate picture. But for Akron, where you're not seeing a lot of new build, you know, it's hard to really know what that in-migration is going to be. And then right now, it's been pretty low. So, I mean, 500 isn't a lot in the grand scheme of things to really move the needle.
And just to give the specific numbers, I mean, it's too much to just put up on here, really. But for Akron, the 2010 census population was 199,110, just under that 200,000 mark. And what we're calculating for 2040 is 157,715. So around 160. It's semi-realistic. You never know. It's definitely better than the 110. You know.
Right.
But it comes to 20.8%. Over the whole period reduction, and that's 0.8% loss each year, you know, losing around 1% each year. When you look at it like that, I mean, it kind of follows historic, you know, recent history. So we always hope for the best. You know, we want to be a high growth area.
I don't even know if growth is going to stop.
Well, then let's start doing something about it. We need to control this development. We need to put transportation infrastructure where it serves the higher population density corridors. We need to start building a transportation system for 2040 that might start to be post-carbon. We're probably by 2040 not going to have cheap fuel. These people that build their new homes in Brimfield or out in the country are going to regret that decision. And I think it would be good in the 2040 plan, using this data, that maybe we try to correct what we see is wrong here. People like the more openness of the rural communities out in southern Portage County where I live, and I think we'd like to keep it that way. Us farmers don't want more city people complaining about our cows, especially when they get out the fence and run up their yard. But I see we need to have more of a mission, and we've talked about this before on previous plans, to direct land use. It doesn't seem to be our mission. Some MPOs seem to have more of a land use planning mandate. I don't know how that gets determined, but we've always just been transportation.
Some of them are regional planning commissions, and they actually do
what I'm saying.
Yeah, regional land use planning. We're just formally an MPO.
How can we help steer the developers to the right path for a correct future? I mean, all of it. TRV, it was nothing but millennials don't want to own and drive cars. We're looking at a projection that seems to be a lot of people are going to want to drive cars. Those transit systems have great trouble serving the rural areas. And maybe that's not the scenario we want to allow to be built. We need to bring people back to the urban core. Cleveland's making great strides in the urban CBU of expanding the population there. What is Akron doing to get downtown residency? I'm sure some of these buildings here in town could be recycled for residential use.
I saw the Landmark building actually just received this Ohio tax credit for
some sort of redevelopment.
Another one?
Yeah. I mean, we've been talking about that since they cleaned out the asbestos in 06.
Yeah.
So
maybe something will happen.
Yeah, but
they're like over $5 million, I think, now.
Yeah. I mean, Youngstown is ahead of Akron in terms of the number of units they have downtown. I mean, other than if you don't count, especially if you don't count the quads and the depot, you know.
I think to your point, though, I mean, we have, you know, as a agency, we've had a preservation first, so we're not by any means spending, you know, new roads or anything that encourages, you know, growth, whether it's residential or commercial, industrial, you know, in those rural areas. You know, I think all of our policies are, you know, promoting kind of investing in what we have, especially in the existing areas, the already built up, you know, I mean, with transportation is what we have. I mean, also, you know, looking at land use, I mean, I think those trends are what we are supporting. And then, like you said, you know, getting more into the transit and bike and ped, how we promote those as opposed to...
The hard thing is that our policymakers, you know, and I don't say this necessarily even in agreement, but I think the reality is that no one is envisioning a world without an automobile. And even I think when you talk to people about the future, I think most people are assuming a world with an automobile that functions in some other way.
Right, you know, the autonomous electric.
Right, or you know, fuels. You know, all those things. And even, I mean, you know, you can buy a Leaf, Nissan Leaf, that goes 100 miles on an electrical outlet, you know, plugged into an electrical outlet. And so even that, like, one of the things, as say, like, the planning student of when, you know, I was in school, one of the things that we always talked about, well, when peak oil comes, like, people are not going to be able to drive anymore. And I think the reality that a lot of people are coming to is that when peak oil or when that period comes, we're going to find a new method to continue to live the way we want to live. And that's a challenge that I think, especially from a policy perspective, is tough, because there are a lot of people in those positions that still see the automobile as, you know, in some way, shape, or form, is going to be the main piece of transportation. You know, some of the streetcar stuff hasn't gone over real well. I mean, in terms of politically, some, you know, is it the one in Georgia? Is like the county suing? Somebody's suing somebody over one of the streetcar lines. And, you know, so I think that while we can continue to push the alternatives, I think it's going to be hard to realistically at this point, you know, other than maybe doing some alternative scenarios. And again, I'm not trying to be Debbie Downer, but just when we've approached this in the past, you know, there's a lot of resistance from a lot of policymakers to envision a world without an automobile. And there's some good arguments as to why that is the case. But it's one of the challenges as staff that we face when talking about the future.
There's a demographic. What's the median age of our policymakers in AMACS? Now, I've been to that meeting numerous times, and I think the average age there is definitely in the 40s, 40s plus, isn't it? As the millennials come in, I bet you will see the policies change. That was all the buzz at TRB this year.
Yeah, and like you said, Cleveland has done a great, unbelievable job at what they have done with their... I mean, it's even from 2005, 2006 to now, downtown Cleveland has changed. I mean, that they're going to get a grocery store. You know, they finally have enough population downtown that they're going to get a grocery store.
Yeah, Inans.
So, I mean, like, that's... You know, for a city like Cleveland, that's really impressive. And Akron could do that. It's just that hasn't really been the real priority. And, you know, one of the things that Akron's going to run into is, you know, I know there's been some articles about, like, the First Energy building and potentially First Energy moving. There's not enough commercial enterprise to fill the commercial real estate.
I just came from a meeting that they said that they're officially not moving.
Oh, good. Well, I know their lease doesn't run out until, like, 2016, so they would have to pay.
They're not.
I thought you said they are.
But anyway, you know, but what we are going into is that they're, what are we going to do with some of these buildings? You know, when they're not, when we've got buildings that are 30% occupied, you'd like to think that now it's the time to think about maybe there's a different use, a residential use, you know, adding people downtown. And we just haven't seen that transition other than in the student section.
That's true, yeah, definitely a lot of downtown residents.
But it hasn't seemed to grab, say, the young professional, hipster, for lack of a better word.
Well, didn't NEO, the Vibrant Communities Consortium that Jason was involved with, isn't that trying to build more livable cities that would attract the population to the urban core and to existing networks? We've talked about this before.
Yeah,
we build the brownfields, don't
right.
come out and take my green farmland.
Yeah, I mean, in the OSCC, I think what ended up happening is, as most regional things do, you know, a region incorporates everybody, and they got a lot of pushback from everybody else that wasn't in the urban core. And so what ended up happening with the OSCC is that it's a pretty neutered document and policy, because it's like, let's make everybody happy.
And what was the median age of the group that did that? Hey, Dave.
I mean, that's the median age of our area.
Well, that's true. True. Yeah.
You know, that's, I mean, it's...
It'd be one thing if we were piping in all these young professionals.
Attractive for them. I'm ready to move out.
Dave, I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
Why do you live in Brimfield?
I grew up out there, and I'm kind of stuck, and I kind of hate that fact. I really liked living in the urban city area where I took the train to work every day, and I really do miss that. But it's that homeland scenario. But yeah, I don't necessarily practice what I preach. But I'm looking forward to do that in the future.
I have a question. Yeah. You've done these studies before, planning things before, right? Mm-hmm. Have you ever gone back and taken one from your first one and see how close it came?
Yeah,
I'm really interested in that. Like, our director has been here long enough. I think he said that the one he did, I've only been in MS a few years, but yeah, he did one back in the day. He's been here long enough. And that has crossed my mind. We haven't actually done it.
Jason was working on the 2010 plan when he was here.
I'd like to see how badly it was off. This many years. The probability of it actually coming up is probably 50.
And I can say in 1972 we did one of these, and I looked at it. The growth areas that were predicted at that time were all in here.
And field, soft field.
And it was like the year 2000 growth. But it was in a lot of areas in New Franklin, areas where it hasn't really happened. And I don't think back then they foresaw that Cuyahoga County bleed that happened all, and especially on the north side. So you never do know.
I know, but there should be some way of reacting to that so you can adjust this from year to year as the trends become apparent. Mm-hmm. You know, I agree with you because I was in Twinsburg in 1970, mm-hmm. and on a council down there, and the area that now is adjacent to Sullivan is all built up. Was supposed to have been built by 1980.
Yeah.
And we passed the PUD for that area in 1972. It got built in 1990.
Yeah.
You know, so you see that kind of thing, the Chrysler plant thing, you know, that road they built because that was all going to be industrial.
Yeah.
Not happen.
Right. So,
now we got a bottling company up there. A lot of jobs lost there.
Is part of your projection related to the, I don't know how it is locally, but nationally, vehicle miles traveled on a trend line declining, you know, per capita? And is that incorporated here? Is that something? I don't even know if that data available locally here.
Yeah, we try. Dave works on that somewhat. There's another report we do, the congestion management process. It really looks at vehicle miles traveled, trends and everything. And these things combined kind of work their way into the plan.
May I have your attention, please? The library will close in 20 minutes. Please make final selections now. Thank you.
We've got our good mindset.
The projections of, like, the national, well, when you're talking about population, we would usually look at, you know, you look at the national population trends, which really aren't that helpful to us just because we're such a smaller subset. And really what we find is we're sort of bucking those trends sometimes in negative ways. And from the employment, it's sort of the same thing. You look at, you know, the industries, what the industries are doing, what do we have of those industries, and trying to forecast. When it comes to the vehicle miles traveled, this will go into the model and it will project stuff, one of the things that has to be is validated to sort of this statewide survey of vehicles and what's expected. And they do that big validation every 10 years, and like Nate was saying, where they used to like cordon people off and ask them, now, you know, it's paying people to have a black box in their car or a GPS, and they use that to like verify the, so basically when we look at our stuff, we're kind of benchmarking against the state, not the nation, but the state in terms of VMT. And then a lot of the national stuff is such estimated, you know, it's not really very hard data, a lot of it's like estimated, so it's not, I mean, it's helpful to see how you're doing in a long trend, but not as helpful for like a specific type thing. I don't know if that answers your question completely. But,
actually, if I could just add one thing, one of the latest technologies being used to kind of track where people are going and coming from is using cellular phone information. Like, is there anyone in here doesn't have a cell phone in their pocket?
It's not in my pocket.
Oh, I mean the cell phone. No, no, but I was just, actually the University of Akron, they were a professor over there that we worked with sometimes was applying for a grant to actually study that technology, how that technology can be used to kind of, now you don't know the purpose of the trip, but you can determine, like,
right, the target.
Yeah, you can tell where a lot of you can tell where that trip originated and where it ended.
Why don't you use Google? I'll tell you where the ball is. They got it all marked down.
What do you mean?
They give you all the data.
What do you mean Google?
They track all that stuff. They got all.
You know, they only want to sell it to you.
Yeah, they can actually go through. You ask what a trip was, they'll tell you what that trip was for. They'll tell you where you went in the store.
They'll predict where you're going next.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Well, then they'll send you an email. Buy this.
You pass the store.
Yeah. Be on your Facebook. All of the advertisements will come up.
Just to get back on topic, we probably have about 5 more minutes. I don't want to end right at 8, but. Were there any other questions or comments or concerns about anything? I think, you know, one of the things I did want to point out on our agenda that we did have in our mail out was that White Pond, there was a project that we were doing on White Pond.
Is it White Pond Drive?
It's actually called White Pond Parkway. And it's a it's about a quarter mile long cul-de-sac street that will be built off of White Pond Drive, and it'll be actually right across the street from the new First Energy office complex. And I use White Pond Drive quite often, so I'm familiar with it. And this must have been planned for a long time, because when they widened White Pond Drive, they actually put in the curb returns for this new street. So it must have been it must have been planned for a long time, but Akron has money left over from that widening project, and they want to use it to actually build this new street called White Pond Parkway, and it'll be about a quarter mile long, like I said, cul-de-sac. It'll be a I think they want to develop a commercial area there. I don't want to say industrial, but commercial. Very similar to what's on the south side of 77, where you have the new development on I forget the name of that street, but on the it's south of 77 and parallel with 77. There's a street over there. It's very similar to cul-de-sacs, and at the end there's like a Akron. There's like a medical office building, and I think there's a school.
Oh, what's that? Right next to the JCC.
Yes, right next to the JCC. So it'll be similar to that, I believe, is what they're.
Yeah.
But bottom line is this. This will be a new street, and for air quality purposes, it's not considered significant, but it is a new street, so we'll still have to run an air quality. It'll have to be in our air quality network, so we'll have to do some analyses. But anyhow, we did want to bring that up. Mention it that will be a new project.
Anything discussed about that at the TAC?
No, it was approved. I mean, it was a resolution, and basically we had approved it in December, but they wanted us to add another whereas that said we had included an air quality component because they decided that it was air quality insignificant, but significant. So,
again,
so it's very procedural.
But I want to just point out that what the project's going to do is open up the land for greenfield development. Yeah. When we just spent 10 minutes
right.
talking about the need to redevelop urban core,
right.
Exactly. So it's we're exactly. cross purposes here
right.
a little bit.
But it is in Akron, so that's what Akron would argue, you know, is that trying to keep the city
I'm in Akron, too.
Are we going to have any sort of bus or transit service down that street? Probably not.
Well, I believe there is bus service on White Pond.
White Pond, yeah, has service out there.
It's quite possible.
If the development justifies, I guess
they could change a route. Right, they could easily route a bus in there. But I know White Pond does have bus service, correct?
Yep.
Yes, that's what I thought.
And we did have some policy members bring it up in December, but we do expect to have a discussion about that project, because I think there are other communities that are like, hey, we're doing Fix It First, so why should we be building this new spur? But then the real catch is that it's leftover money from an earmark that has to be spent adjacent to the property. And so I think from Akron's perspective, they either abuse it or lose it. Mm. So I don't think there's anything imminent in development, but it was like, well, if we're going to, either we get this money or nobody does, sort of thing.
This money was earmarked for White Pond Drive, and it has to be spent on a project that is related to White Pond Drive. This Akron can't take this money and spend it on High Street. It has to be spent on something adjacent to or something that is related to White Pond Drive. And like Curtis said, it's the money's already there. It's just if they don't spend it, they're going to have to give it back.
You could use Bill Mackey's idea from last time and build a robot.
Yeah, put a robot up.
What?
That should be.
You missed that. Take our lead on this one. No, robot. Unfortunately, he's not here tonight. He lets us know he wouldn't be able to make it. But I agree with you. One of the things that we struggle with as staff is the cross purposes of, that economic development in our area trumps all. So you could have the best plan in the world. We talked about this in the Stowe Kent Shopping Plaza where the Myers coming in. They spent 2-3 years crafting a plan for, mixed use development with, human scale retail and all this stuff. And then the call came in that Meyer wanted to move in there. They just threw all out the zoning and said, come on in, Meyer. And then it was like, well, that was really, we had a nice plan, but this is Meyer. They're bringing in all these union jobs, So. That's one of the frustrating things with planning is that, in this area where we're desperate for that economic development, a lot of people don't care if it's in a green field, a brown field, or a yellow field. They just want it. And that's the challenge that we always deal with.
So. Yellow fields are pretty.
Yeah.
On that
If anyone has anything to talk about,
the library will close in 10
Chapter
minutes.
Chapter 5A, draft.
Please check out your materials page. Now.
Yes.
What is Thank the capital you. Expansion project Metro is listing here for 11.5?
Yeah. I think it's the bus canopy. They're wanting to build an outdoor canopy that they can put a lot of their, I don't know what form this thing's going to take, but they got special funding from the state.
Well, there was another listing somewhere else in here that was like 1.6 million or something like that.
Yeah,
what? 1.5.
Is this on the TIP document?
Correct.
My guess is that those are very preliminary numbers. Those are spaceholder numbers.
Okay, that almost looks like another a rapid.
Right. I don't think it's that because we have to kind of provide that information, and I don't think they know exactly. But it's 53. They get that money, but they don't know what they're using it for yet. That would be my guess, but I don't know for sure.
Okay.
We can look into it, though. We'll ask.
All right.
Two things quick. The schedule, that will be determined at the policy meeting here next week. Or did I miss seeing it in here?
The schedule.
The meeting schedule for CIC policy.
Oh, it was provided in the last mail out.
Okay, in December.
But it's also online. Meeting, and I think it's on the agenda.
March, I believe. Last week in March.
April 16th.
Well, not till April.
Yeah. Wow. Quarterly meetings, and we might move that up a week depending on, we might actually be going through the public involvement for the new transportation improvement program. So if we do that, ODOT has a two-week period. We might try to move this meeting up so that it fits into that two-week period so we can discuss that.
Let us know. But now policy and TAC will continue.
We'll continue to stay on that same schedule.
Okay, so we can still come and observe.
Oh, yeah. More than welcome to come and observe.
And then I did attend PRB. I have some stuff for the staff or anybody else that wants to look at it. It's quite a program with lots of information exchange. So I'll share that with the staff or anybody else that's interested.
Awesome. All right, thank you, everyone. Appreciate it.